Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, another souvenir of my visit last week to the Hoover Institution, the right-wing think tank at Stanford. A talk with one of their public opinion experts, Morris Fiorina. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll check in with a frequent guest on Behind the News, Yanis Varoufakis of the University of Athens, to talk about the economic crisis in his country, as well as the tremors in the broader Eurozone. Before that, a few words in the economic news. It sure looks like the U.S. economy is stalling out. What steam the recovery had late last year and early this, and it wasn't much, but it was a non-zero amount, seems to be dissipating. Leading indexes are rolling over, and many economic indicators are coming in under already low expectations. Most importantly, the U.S. employment report for May, released on Friday morning, was something of a bummer. Employers added a total of just 54,000 jobs last month, a third the recent average, and less than a quarter the long-term average. Governments, mainly local governments, shed almost 30,000 jobs, thanks to fiscal crises all over the place. Few sectors within the private economy, though, showed any strength. Well, over half the gain was accounted for by what I call the eat, drink, and get sick sectors, healthcare, and bars and restaurants. Despite their virtues, these sectors are not the stuff that drives an economy over the longer term. The unemployment rate rose a tenth to 9.1%, though the broad U6 rate, which includes people working part-time who want full-time work but can't find it, as well as those who have given up the job search as hopeless, fell a tenth to a still awful 15.8%. Only about one in six people who were officially unemployed in April found a job in May. More of the unemployed, about 1 in 5, just dropped out of the labor force altogether. About 1 in 25 people who were employed in April lost their jobs in May. Both the rates of job gain and job loss are actually quite low by historical standards. The U.S. economy, while always a brutal place, used to have some dynamism behind it. Now it's just a brutal place without the dynamism. While this month's report was a disappointment, it can hardly be called a surprise. We're likely to see more of the same in the coming months. It's probably wrong to think of this as the leading edge of a new recession. This kind of slow growth is just what you'd expect from a post-financial crisis recovery. In fact, the average post-crisis employment gain, based on the IMF sample of such that I've discussed before, would be about 55,000 a month at this point in the recovery cycle, almost exactly what we got. And if the economy continues to follow this script, it could take 10 years to recover the jobs we lost in the Great Recession. But few people in power seem to care about this. Back after a musical break to talk public opinion. Since this is the Hoover segment, I was a bit of the gigue from Bach's Partita No. 1, performed by Bill Buckley's favorite pianist, Rosalind Turek. That was her old 1950s version, not alas, the one she recorded in the 1990s at Buckley's house. My first guest is Morris Fiorina. Fiorina is a professor of political science at Stanford and a fellow at the Hoover Institution. If you were listening last week, you heard a lot about my week as a media fellow at that Stanford-based right-wing think tank. It was a foray into some strange ideological territory. But I was a conservative in my youth, so it wasn't as strange for me as it might have been for some others. What is strange is that Hoover, a keynote in the apparatus of reaction, paid both me and my wife, Liza Featherstone, also a journalist, a very generous stipend to spend a week in their posh offices talking to with their fellows. Despite the great material temptations, though, they didn't win us over. And although I'm pretty critical of a lot of their fellows, I'm still grateful for their generosity and will tip a hat to them for extending an invitation to their political others. Unlike some of his Hoover colleagues, though, Fiorina is not a right-wing ideologue. He's basically a rather centrist, mainstream scholar of public opinion and elections. He's written extensively about how the so-called culture wars don't really exist, mainly because the mass of Americans don't care passionately about political issues. Sadly, he's probably right about that, which is always a disappointment to those of us who do care passionately about politics. Morris Fiorina, who is, as far as I can tell, no relation to Carly. So let's start by talking about the culture war, which I believe Pat Buchanan declared almost 20 years ago in a speech that Molly Ivan said sounded better in the original German. You're saying it's largely an illusion. We've been fighting phantoms.
Yes.
Why is that?
The reason is simply that about 15% of the American population, which is the public face of politics in America, the activists, the leaders, the interest groups, they are in fact engaged in a culture war. What I call the normal American, about 85% of the population, looks basically the same as the normal American did a generation ago. They're centrist in their views. They are non-ideological in their approach to politics. They're more pragmatic. And they don't particularly like the take-no-prisoners style of modern politics.
Alan Wolfe said in a book, came out about 10, 12 years ago, that the default position of the American middle class is ambivalence. Is that
yes,
sort of what you're talking
about? Yes, I think that's true. I think Alan and I have talked and corresponded, and basically my results looking at national polls are fully consistent with his results based on in-depth interviews of American families.
So now is this ambivalence or the split the difference, which seems to be the instinct of the American middle, is that a project of disengagement and the people are more passionately engaged or more well-informed and care more about the issues, or is something else going on?
Both. I mean, certainly the people who are active and participate in politics are more engaged and more knowledgeable and more ideological. The middle is a heterogeneous group. It consists of some people who are disengaged. It consists of some people who are simply moderate in their views. They're between the parties. It consists of people who are not at home in either party. What do you do if you're an economic conservative and a social liberal, for example? And so the middle that swings back and forth is really much more heterogeneous than either the conservative right or the liberal left.
Now, is that because of a lack of what those of us who study these things or are obsessed with them would call the lack of a coherent political philosophy, or is it just more pragmatic and fluid?
Well, to me, I don't think either on the right or the left we have a coherent political philosophy. We have liberals and we have conservatives, but how do issues become defined as part of a coherent ideology? What fundamental underlying principle makes being pro-choice, high tax, what else can you think of, environmentally friendly, why do those things hang together? On the other side, being aggressively at foreign affairs, being pro-life, being low tax, what makes those things hang together? I think it's ideologies are social constructions. And I think the people on the left and the right, they have been, for whatever reason, they have socially constructed ideologies. If somebody doesn't have that, I don't regard them as being any less coherent or any less interesting. I regard them as being, actually, there's something I think admirable about approaching things on a case-by-case basis and saying sometimes we need government, sometimes we need a free market. Let's just see what works.
What do you think of Tom Frank's argument from What's the Matter with Kansas that Republicans have been very successful at using social issues to distract people or to get people to vote against their material interests?
Yeah, I love Tom Frank's book. I have seldom had more fun reading a book. Unfortunately, it is simply wrong on all the facts. That the facts of the matter are that, as Andrew Gelman wrote, what's the matter with Connecticut is the question that needs to be asked. In every state you look at, wealthy people vote Republican more than poor people. The difference is that the relationship is stronger in the poorer states than it is in wealthy states like Connecticut, New York, California, where the wealthy people are in fact almost the most liberal. So it's not that the poor people are the victims of false consciousness, it's wealthy people are traitors to their class, in the old Marxist terminology.
Well, Kansas has also been one of the most reliable Republican states for a century.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And the other thing about Tom is, and I mean, I think he's really a great writer and so forth, but he's a younger man, and he dates a lot of this from abortion. Now, I'm older, and I remember the Democratic Party coming apart on race long before abortion came along. And so,
Tom is very emphatic that race isn't really part of the picture.
That's right. And I think, I mean, if you were around in those days, I think you date the Democratic Party fracturing and the white working class leaving the party long before abortion and social issues came to the fore. It was a racial thing.
Now, there's a common perception on the left, where I spend my time, that the differences between the two parties has narrowed, and that the Democrats are much more conservative on economic issues than they were a generation ago. Now, it's a commonplace among political scientists that the difference between the parties has widened. How do you reconcile these perceptions?
I think it's the difference between relative and absolute positions. That absolutely, I agree with you, the Democrats are much more conservative in a free market, pro-business direction than they were a generation ago. I mean, the Bush tax cuts were hilarious, you think about it. Bush says, I want $700 billion, and the Democrats say, we won't give you a dollar more than $350 billion. but by the same token, the Republicans have moved farther right as well. And so I think, and then, of course, in social issues, the parties have clearly separated. So I think when political scientists study the difference between the parties, they're looking at the relative differences over time, and clearly the parties are farther apart. But I think that the left is correct that the party has become more conservative. It's not they're more like the Republicans, it's just that they're more like the Republicans of 30 years ago than the Republicans of today.
I was just reading a piece by James Carville who said that the Obama today is like the Republicans of 2008,
yes,
and the Republicans are running against their own positions from just a few years ago. What happened to the Republican Party? I mean, it's just been quite amazing to watch this party, which used to be of Eisenhower, used to have a liberal wing, just move further and further to the right. I think, you know, almost some of Ronald Reagan's positions would be untenable in the Republican Party of today. What happened? Is it reflecting popular opinion, the opinion of their funders, the opinion of think tank intellectuals? What prompted this? I think it's certainly one of the most right-wing mainstream parties in the world. What happened? Yeah.
Well, the Republicans, relatives of the Democrats, have always been a more cohesive, more ideological party in the American context. I think a lot of what happened is the party went south. That the party really saw the growth in the Sun Belt as the future. Richard Nixon goes from being pretty amenable to cooperating with civil rights groups in the 50s to playing a Southern strategy only a decade later. And I think the South was, you look at it, it's an area that's developing economically, so it has no use for unions, no use for high taxes, no use for regulation. And the West as well, the growth. And so I think a lot of it is simply that as the base of the Republican Party shifted south, even more conservative economic.
And the pivot of that was around race.
Well, it starts around race, but actually, political scientists think have made the argument that it's a triple whammy in the South. It starts with race, and race breaks the South away from the Democrats. But economics, there's a guy named in Wisconsin named Byron Schaefer who's written on this. Pretty soon economics comes to the fore. As the South is developing economically, then sort of the racial, certain consensus, rough consensus builds on racial issues. But the South becomes very conservative economically. And then the third part of the triple whammy is religion, that the resurgence of evangelicalism, they're coming back into politics, all those things separate the South off from the Democrats. And that third thing also pushes the Republicans to the right on social issues. You couldn't tell a Republican and a Democrat apart on social issues in the population until the early 90s. And sometimes Republicans were more liberal on abortion, sometimes they're less liberal on abortion. That's a pretty modern phenomenon. And so I think you put all those things together and you get the Republican Party moving right. And I think what's happened now, I think their difficulty is they're too much a Texas party, basically. And they can't win in states like California, New York, et cetera.
Well, what's the reason for the outsized influence of the South in national politics? It is a minority region. It's one region out of many. Why does it have such an influence on the national
discourse? Well, it has grown. It's the case that the Midwest and the East now have a minority of the congressional districts in the country. The South and the West now have a majority. You look back 40, 50 years, the South is now, and you look at the 10 biggest cities in the country now as opposed to 30, 40 years ago, and you're picking up Houston and Atlanta and Dallas and Phoenix and all these places that weren't on the map a generation ago. It simply reflects a great deal of demographic change in this country. There's also mythology about the old South. The South was never unilaterally conservative. There were lots of populists in the South. That there were lots of people who, as long as it wasn't about race, were quite happy to embrace big government programs. Federal housing, that was Senator Lister Hill of Alabama. TVA, rural electrification. These were Southerners who really backed all this stuff. As long as it didn't include blacks, they were happy with it. So, I mean, essentially, you lost a lot of when the South went Republican, you lost a lot of Democrats who were fairly liberal on economic issues, but not on social issues.
Yeah, I recall the Huey Long character in All the King's Men is giving early on is giving very dull, long speeches on policy, and his advisor says, "Just tell me you're going to soak the fat boys and leave it at that." That soak the fat boys message would not sell in the South now, would it?
Not now. No.
What happened?
There's a big, many more fat boys in the South now. There's a big, the South, economically speaking, became much more like the rest of the country. Northern has moved South. The economic activity in the South now compared to 30, 40 years ago is just striking. So the appeal just isn't the same. You don't have a small class, a planter class, lording it over a class of really poor agrarian people. You have a much more typical population profile.
But there's still a large share of the population, low wage, low income, high poverty rates, and very low health insurance rates. You would think that might be some fertile soil for economic populism.
They still vote Democratic. I mean, this is what I think what people have shown about Frank's book. That if you look at the poorer states, the poorer people still vote Democratic. It's just that there's a big southern middle class that is much more for Republican, plus the evangelicals.
Now, going back to what you said about one of the things you listed about the South was the presence of evangelicals, and doesn't that suggest that the culture war does have some resonance in the South? I mean, as I recall, one of the best predictors of voting in 2004 was frequency of church attendance. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that does matter to some degree, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It matters more in the South than elsewhere. The church attendance thing, I think the thing people tend to forget is that it's not just a characteristic of voters, it's a characteristic of the choices they're being offered. The relationship between church attendance and Democratic or Republican voting hasn't been something that's been building gradually over time. It's something that suddenly emerged in 1992. And I think the reason was Bill Clinton basically made it, you know, as long as the Democrats were nominating Mike Dukakis, a conservative Greek Orthodox boy, or Walter Mondale, the son of a Methodist minister, or let alone Jimmy Carter, a Sunday school teacher and born-again Christian, why would church attendance have been related to how you voted? But when you suddenly nominate a guy who's caused pain in his marriage, has inhaled, has gay friends, etc., then suddenly the sort of the religious dimension begins to have relevance. And it's been actually declining in recent years. The relationship between church attendance since the Clinton years has been declining. But still, I mean, it is more important there than in, it's the most morally traditional part of the country. What's interesting is and I don't think we fully understand this, why did the evangelicals whose home was traditionally Democratic, why did they go Republican? What you have to look at is what elites are doing, what elites are sending, the messages. And it's clear the Democrats were moving in a more secular direction, the Republicans were moving in a more socially conservative direction, and they realigned it.
No, but the secular share of the population is roughly doubled over the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or at least people are willing to admit it now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. is this going to change the political picture?
The political picture, the change is constantly occurring. The thing I didn't mention a moment ago is even in the evangelical community, there's generational change going on. And the younger generation has more people who sort of agree with Mitch Daniels that it's time to call a truce on these issues. That a generation that's
tried to... Well, even some who think that climate change is a moral issue.
Yeah, exactly. They say the only agenda can't be just the so-called below-the-belt issues, abortion and gay marriage. It's also got to be lots of other issues that relate to stewardship of the earth and so forth. And the fact is that the legislative and constitutional revision strategy that's been tried for a generation has failed. And so some of the younger people were saying, let's turn our attention away from that. They haven't become liberals on social issues, but their view is, let's try to win hearts and minds and not pass laws. And let's broaden the agenda as well. And so I think, you look at the leader, I have in my second book, I have tables on the ages of some of these people, the Jerry Falwells and the James Dobsons and so forth. And you can see it's an old, old movement. As a matter of fact, a lot of what's going on in the U.S. now is generational change.
The leaders are aging, but also the bases as well.
Yeah, the bases as well. And the younger generation is just isn't fully in tune with the old leadership, especially.
I'm speaking with Morris Fiorina at the Hoover Institution. Let's talk about the present some now. The Republicans scored a great victory last November, and it seems to have gone to their heads, and they're pushing a maximalist agenda. They just suffered a defeat upstate New York, with a long Republican-held seat, Jack Kemp's whole seat. I see a division among Republican thinkers. Some are saying, let's double down with the agenda and embrace the Tea Party, and others are saying, this is a wake-up call. Do you see anything in the tea leaves?
Overreacting to a victory, this is just an occupational hazard of politicians. The Democrats did it in 2008. Bush did it in 2004. It's just they all do it. They all think they suddenly have a mandate to do much more than the electorate actually wants. I don't actually think that the Republicans have overreacted. I think the problem is they're caught in a bind. On the one hand, they have this absolutely roaring fire at the base, the Tea Party, that's demanding all these things, and they can't,
with an agenda that appeals to what, 15 or 20%?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I my view is, Boehner and Cantor are walking a fine line. They sort of know what has to be done, politically speaking, and they also don't want to. They know what creates a winning coalition, and it's not the full Tea Party agenda, and yet they're caught with all these people on the base, and so I think they're just
and they must understand like this government shutdown business. The United States Treasury cannot default. But there are some people in the back benches who think it can.
They do, yeah. I mean, I won't tell tales out of, but some of the politicians have been here, and they'll sort of explain privately that the problem is like you know, you don't see Boehner enforcing party cohesion in the way that that Pelosi did, in the way that Denny Hastert and others before him did. They can't. This new Tea Party group is just off the reservation. I think they're just desperately trying to walk a fine line between being responsible, creating a winning presidential coalition, and not alienating these people who are at the base.
But then if you look at the budget that Paul Ryan proposed, this is really a true believer's budget. I mean, the Medicare proposals, for example, would require seniors to double their out-of-pocket spending. And this seems to be not very popular. But now, who is he appealing to with that budget, and what are the political consequences going to be?
A lot of the policy analysts think it's a ridiculously conservative, I mean, does too little budget, because it basically kicks the can down the road for another generation and doesn't ask anybody over 55 to bear any sacrifice. Now, why should anybody over 55 be spared the burdens that are coming down the pike? In some ways, I think it's sort of timid.
Well, the seniors vote heavily, and
exactly, yeah.
And young people think they're not going to get anything anyway, it's just a purely political calculation.
Yeah, but and I think, I mean, we keep talking about this need to have an adult conversation. I think we do. I mean, at some point, that of course people don't want to cut Medicare and cut Medicaid, but I think if they actually understood the numbers, and cut Social Security for that matter, if they actually saw the numbers and understood them, I think they know something has to be done. It's just the idea of turning people over to the tender mercies of the insurance companies. People are not really up for it. I think they'd rather see government doing the cutting or the pushing back. John Cogan and I were just talking about that today, and see insurance companies doing it. So I think in a sense he's responsible in starting the debate. I think the time spans in his proposal are too long. I think basically they're embracing it because it's the only thing out there.
Well, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office projections for the next decade, the mandatory spending programs increase their share of GDP by about 1%. Mm-hmm. This is not an emergency in the sense that it has to be solved in a year or two. It's almost as if they're trying to create a sense of emergency to push an agenda that wouldn't be popular if we had an adult conversation about it. Why this sense of urgency? Are they trying to push something that they know couldn't sell in more normal times?
No, I mean, look, I think policy people have been saying for more than a decade, we got to do something. They're looking down the road. And we've kicked it about as far down the road, I think, as we can. And I every year we delay, it gets harder. It gets the cuts that, or the reductions have to be made, get more difficult to make. So I think it's actually responsible for either party to be pushing this stuff now. But it's just that the way that Matt Miller had a good column in this the other day, Republicans hammer the Democrats when they're about they're going to cut Medicaid. And now the Democrats are hammering the Republicans because they're cutting Medicare and Medicaid. And then it's going to be the same thing again, that at some point we have to come to grips with the problems.
So what do you see as we're heading towards, you know, the 2012 election season is getting close? A few months ago, it looked like the Republicans had some pretty clear sailing. Is it, or the water's a little choppier for them than
I think anybody who tries to predict, we have enough in our recent history to say, if you try to predict a year and a half ahead, you know, James Carville wrote a book after 2008 called 40 More Years, How the Democrats Will Rule the Next Generation. we saw.
That looks funny now.
Yeah, Amazon will give you a real good discount on this book now. I think things are choppy. I mean, if I had to bet now, I'd take Obama against the field, but we could have a double dip or something like that. The Republican position in the Senate is very strong, just because they're defending, or the Democrats are defending 2/3 of the seats. That's the Republicans can attack and have relatively few to defend. It'll be hard for the Democrats to take the House as well, because the redistricting will give the Republicans some more seats. The population movement gives the Republicans a few more seats. I had to bet right now, I'd say Obama wins re-election and Democrats lose both houses. That would be my guess. But there's a long, long way to go.
What do you think of Rita Scherer's analysis that the long-term demographics favor the Democrats? And maybe Carville's case was overstated, but a lot of the Republican base is aging, and the growing areas, kind of suburban, affluent professionals that care about the environment and education, are a growing share of the electorate. Do you think there's something to that?
If neither party changes what it does, yeah. But the point is, you can't expect a rational party. Now, maybe the Republicans aren't rational, but you can't expect a party to ignore those kind of trends forever. And so, I mean, you have Republicans now saying sort of the positions the party has on immigration are suicidal, and they got to be changed, and there's got to be greater reach out to minority groups. And so I expect the Republicans will not sit idly by forever and just watch these groups fall in the hands of the Democrats. And so, I mean, I think he's identified clearly a danger. Nothing in demography is inevitable, that people react to the demographic changes they see.
That was Morris Fiorina, a professor of political science at Stanford and a fellow at the Hoover Institution. I'll be having some more Hoover interviewees on in the coming weeks. It's interesting that Fiorina had no real response to my citation of Congressional Budget Office data showing that there is no fiscal emergency. All he could do was cite the anxieties of experts. That seems to be how politics gets done in the mainstream. Pundits don't read the original sources. They just cite scare stories from other pundits. That's hegemony for you. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. After a musical break, we'll be back to hear from Yiannis Varoufakis. Some of Kraftwerk doing Trans-Europe Express, a live version from around 2004. My next guest is Yiannis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. Yiannis has been a frequent guest in this show over the last couple of years as Greece fell into an economic crisis that has, along with crises in other peripheral countries like Spain and Ireland, thrown the entire Eurozone into a tizzy. You can read his writings on the topic on his blog at Yiannis Varoufakis, that's yiannisvaroufakis.eu. yiannisvaroufakis.eu. Yiannis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yiannis. Martin Wolf had a column in the Financial Times the other day saying that the euro as a project has failed, and it looks like things are going to blow apart. Do you agree with this diagnosis?
I'm afraid very much so. The euro is unraveling. There is, of course, an interesting incongruity there, because on the one hand, it is appreciating vis-a-vis the US dollar, but on the other hand, its very foundation is crumbling all around us.
Why is it appreciating against the dollar?
Well, it's quite interesting. There are a number of forces at play. Firstly, let's not forget how markets work. Markets do not react to the fundamentals so much. They react to differences and changes in expectations. The other day, for instance, the Australian dollar appreciated on the news that the Australian economy shrunk by 1.2%, which sounds absurd. But then again, if you realize that the expectation was that the Australian economy, because of the floods in Queensland, would have shrunk by 2%, and it only shrunk by 1.2%, well, it wasn't that bad. So the Australian dollar appreciated. Something similar is happening here in the Eurozone. Most market players would have expected the Eurozone crumbling to be faster than it is. So in the short run, their expectations proved more pessimistic than the reality. Therefore, this gives a little bit of a boost to the euro. Secondly, you have the fundamental profound difference in interest rates between the United States and Europe. In the United States, you're still in 0.5% territory. Here in Europe, we are at 1.25, and it's quite obvious that the ECB, the European Central Bank, is going to increase interest rates very soon. And thirdly, even if the euro is to crumble and collapse, the bits and pieces that will remain, that is the new currencies that will emerge, like for instance the new Deutschmark, they are going to appreciate enormously. So to some extent, the appreciation of the euro reflects the prediction, the expectation that a part of the euro will be appreciating massively come the day when the euro crashes and burns.
Okay, now let's go back to why the euro is a hopeless project now. Is it doomed, or could we just peel off a few countries in the periphery and keep a core within a eurozone, or is the whole thing doomed if any number of countries peel off?
It is definitely doomed if any of the deficit countries leave, even one. There's been a lot of talk recently about Greece being forced through the exit of the eurozone. And even here in Greece, there's been an attempt to scare off members of parliament of the ruling party by suggesting that unless they toe the line, then Greece will be thrown out of the eurozone. Now, it is possible, of course, you know, all sorts of madness is possible in this topsy-turvy world of ours, that Greece will be thrown out. But if Greece is thrown out, if the Greek prime minister on Friday night announces that the drachma will be reconstituted on Monday, then I am completely and utterly convinced that within a few days, Germany will get out of the euro. The reason being that the very announcement of a Greek exit from the eurozone will trigger a sequence of defaults, beginning with the Greek banks, moving on to a number of eurozone banks. Then immediately the speculation will be on that something similar will happen in Ireland. So Ireland must either get out of the eurozone itself or erect barriers preventing capital outflows from Ireland. That would be a major violation of the European Union's rules. It would also have to reinstate border controls to stop people from getting money out of the country. Any such event is going to cause the financial markets to panic. The Spanish debt, the Spanish bonds yields are going to go through the roof. Suddenly you will have insolvent banks and insolvent states the size of Spain. To keep together the eurozone, or what is left of the eurozone, at that stage will cost the Germans more than €1 trillion, and they are not going to pay for it. Instead, they will opt for the parachute. They will bail themselves out by recreating their own currency, their own new Deutschmark or whatever, and get out of the eurozone. So, yes, it is possible that countries can come out of the eurozone, deficit countries, but the moment they do, then the eurozone is indeed doomed.
Wolf said in his column that for the euro to work, a euro deposit in a Greek bank has to be effectively the same as a euro deposit in a German bank. That's clearly not the case. Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, the eurozone is a little bit like, and Martin Wolf says that, and I think he's correct, it's a little bit like the gold standard of yesteryear. So we have common currency, fixed exchange rates. We have a kind of linkage between central banks such that when there is a deficit in one country, then the central bank of that deficit country effectively borrows from the central bank of the surplus country in order to maintain the balance. Now, as we speak, the Bundesbank, the German central bank, is owed more than €340 billion by central banks of deficit countries. And these imbalances are spreading, they're accelerating, they're multiplying as the crisis deepens and recession becomes the name of the day, in the order of the day, in countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, while countries like Germany and Holland are pushing ahead, growing, you know, with positive growth rates. So it's like a system which is being placed under increasing strain. At some point, something will have to give, and it will either be the euro that gives, or the commitment of our European leaders to continue thinking of the European Union as a confederacy at a monetary level without having any sense of federation at the level of fiscal policy, at the level of surpluses and the way that they ought to be recycled in any decent and sustainable and balanced currency union.
You write in your piece that in the absence of a common fiscal policy, the central banks of Europe have been acting as fiscal agents. What do you mean by that?
Well, supposedly, in capitalist economies, there is a separation between monetary policy and fiscal policy. So the central bank in the United States, in Europe, in Britain, supposedly is looking after the money supply, interest rates, the banking system, and the treasury looks after taxes and government expenditure and debt. Now, in the Eurozone, we decided in our great wisdom 10-15 years ago that we're going to forge links between absolutely unbreakable links in the monetary systems of our 15 disparate economies. We're going to lock our monetary systems together, but at the same time we will have no fiscal policy at the union level. So fiscal policy is left to individual states. It's like in the United States. Imagine in the United States, if you didn't have a U.S. Treasury, you had the Fed running monetary policy, interest rate policy, minding after the dollar and all that, and you had no U.S. Treasury at the federal level. And instead, it was up to individual states to collect taxes and spend and borrow. And at the same time, and this is the absurdity of it all, the banks of the different states are under the supervision and control of the states. And if there is a bank run in any state, then it is the particular state government that has to bail its banks out. Now, if this had happened in 2008 in the state of Nevada, for instance, the state of Nevada would have simply been obliterated from the face of the earth. And this contagion would have spread throughout the United States. So this is exactly what we have here. Now, in the absence of a common fiscal policy, the central bank system in Europe, faced with this crisis, which is an existential crisis, I mean, if they allow it to follow its course, then the euro system would have already have gone. It would have already collapsed. So what they do is this. The Central Bank of Greece, for instance, lends oodles of money to the commercial banks. The commercial banks need that money because their loan book is full of bad loans due to the recession. Now, where does the Central Bank of Greece get the money? It doesn't print it because it doesn't have a printing press, since we have a common currency and the only printing press resides in Frankfurt. So what happens is the Greek Central Bank effectively borrows it from the German Central Bank or from the Dutch Central Bank, from central banks that have surpluses. And at the same time, the Central Bank of Greece, the more it lends money to the Greek commercial banks in exchange for collateral, which is Greek state sovereign debt, that's what it is, this is the collateral, it's Greek bonds, Greek state bonds. Effectively, so what happens is, indirectly, the German central bank is financing the Greek state. So this is a form of fiscal policy. So you cannot avoid having a common or some modicum of integration of fiscal policy, even if you are trying damn hard to pretend that this is precisely what you're doing. And the problem with this is that when you have central banks haphazardly and on the sly running fiscal policy, the common fiscal policy, the result is really bad fiscal policy and really bad monetary policy.
What you were describing earlier of the kind of the U.S. without a central bank, rather the U.S. without a central treasury, is actually not unlike what prevailed here in the 19th century. The states were very important. We had a very weak central government. We had no central bank. That led, as the century turned, towards an increased role for the central government, the creation of a central bank, an evolution of the political structure to a more modern national economy. Do you see anything like that happening in Europe as a result of this crisis?
Well, this is the multi-trillion euro question. What you had in the United States of America was a continental consolidation. It was the result of a series of crises that you had in the 19th century, again in the early 20th century, and finally 1929. So it was an evolutionary process that effectively led to the proper federation of the United States. and the U.S. Treasury bills, especially the way that they were utilized by the Roosevelt administration, by the New Dealers, was what created effectively the United States of America that we know today. So the hope here in Europe is that this is one major crisis that will push Europe onto a similar evolutionary path, and that the result of this will be when we're faced with a last-minute decision, do we allow the European integration project to go to pieces, or do we federate in some way, that we will choose the latter. But then again, it isn't clear that this is what's on the mind of our politicians. If you compare the early 20th century in the United States with today, you'll find that there is a great deal more resistance in Europe to the idea of pulling together a significant part of the of sovereign debt, of creating a surplus recycling mechanism, a mechanism which takes surpluses from the surplus regions and surplus member states of the Eurozone and channeling them in the form of productive investments in the deficit regions, something that the military-industrial complex does in the United States, for instance. There is a great deal of resistance. So it's like having Herbert Hoover in government now in Europe. Now, of course, then we may have a 1932 election in the next few years, so to speak. I'm saying this allegorically, that will save the euro. But unless we have some momentous political shift, a gestalt shift, as the Germans might say, then the euro project and this form of continental consolidation on this side of the pond is doomed.
I'm Sugathia Yanis Varoufakis of the University of Athens. The United States, even in the 19th century, had a common language, a common culture, a population that moved about from one place to another, so there are actual ties between people across regions. Is there anything like that in Europe now?
No, and this is a major impediment. It is often said to me that my vision, when I present the argument that I just presented before, that my vision of continental consolidation in Europe is pie in the sky, and it won't happen because we lack linguistic common ground, or we lack cultural common ground. Well, the answer I give to this is that, to this point, which is a legitimate point, is that if we don't have this common cultural background, and we don't have the language skills that will allow us to communicate from Britain all the way to Greece and from Portugal all the way to Sweden, then perhaps European integration was a bad idea. But the one thing we cannot hope for is the perpetuation, the maintenance, the reproduction of the Eurozone that we have now without taking those steps. Europe has an opportunity to prove to the world that cultural differences can be maintained within a union of like-minded, democratic-oriented people. We may miss this chance, this opportunity, and we may not rise up to it, but I think it's up to us.
At the time the euro was being created, I like to quote from Timothy Garton Ash, was that we're undertaking this hair-raising political project of union through money. It does seem like the whole thing was designed by central bankers and financiers and elite bureaucrats with no sense of what it really meant to tie all these different countries together under a common currency. I mean, money is not just simply a unit of account. It's a principle of social organization.
Absolutely. Money, let's not forget, emerged, paper money in particular, as a means of bringing together nation states and creating a modicum of national sovereignty and all the paraphernalia that comes with social organization at the state level. So anyone who thinks of money as a means of exchange and a store of value has completely missed the point of its importance. But let me tell you a story that which I heard was related to me, and I have it on good authority. In the early 1990s, Jacques Delors, who was then the president of the European Commission, and he was not an unwise person. He of all the presidents of the European Commission, he was the most weighty intellect. He was the one that suggested to the important heads of state at the time, President Mitterrand of France and Helmut Kohl of Germany, and Chancellor Kohl of Germany, that building a Eurozone simply on the basis of a common monetary system would be to invite trouble and to make the whole process of integration contingent upon a very long period without a crisis. And Mitterrand, apparently, who was quite a smart person, whatever else you may think of him, turned around to Jacques Delors and said, listen, I agree with you, but we don't have the political clout as political leaders to bring about both a monetary and a fiscal union. What we will do is we will bind these people together and simply wait. And wait for what? Wait for the big crisis that will come in 10 or 15 years. When that crisis comes, and I will probably be dead by then, and he was quite prescient on that, my successors will have to decide on whether they are going to enhance and deepen the union or let it go to the dogs. And I think that he has proven quite prophetic.
The current leadership doesn't seem characterized by vision.
I'm afraid not. What has happened in the last 15 years, Doug, I think this is at least a speculative thought that I have, is that, well, this is a global phenomenon, I think. Political goods have devalued. Having political authority, being a prime minister, being a president, has lost a lot of the power that came with it. The office of prime minister, the office of president, has lost much of its veneer and much of its capacity to change the world. And as political goods have devalued and financial goods have revalued, the quality of the politicians that have stepped up and have volunteered to go through this painful process of becoming elected or getting themselves to elected office, that quality has diminished. At least that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it.
Earlier in the week, I think it was earlier in the week, I've kind of lost track of time, but there was a plan essentially for the European central authorities to take over Greek economic policy. Really, as was said at the time, kind of impose a New York City model, displace elected government and have a committee of bankers essentially running the government of Greece. Is this happening and how's this playing in Greece?
We will know by the 20th of June. Obviously, Greeks are not very happy with it, but I have to tell you that there is a large segment of the population who are so sick and tired of politicians that they have lost interest in questions of both sovereignty and democracy. I saw an opinion poll recently, which is not surprising, even though it is extremely depressing, that up to 30% of Greeks would not mind a strong leader, unencumbered by parliamentary processes, who will do as he will in order to get us out of the crisis. Now, painful images of the 1930s come to one's mind. Now, regarding sovereignty, most Greeks are very cross with this. But nevertheless, there is also a quite large proportion of the population who think, well, we messed up. What do you expect? Our creditors will come and look after their interests directly. Now, it seems to me more likely than not that this is going to go ahead. It is a major, major threat for the very notion of European democracy when the right to representation is curtailed on the basis of one's wealth or on the basis of one's debts. And if this happens in Europe, effectively, we will have undermined, in precisely the same way that waterboarding undermined centuries of human rights successes in the United States, this change in the rules of engagement within the European Union, the introduction of foreign non-Greek officials who will be privatizing at will, setting prices for assets, public assets that will be sold, deciding who they will sell it to and what they will do with the proceeds, this will be just as much of a challenge to basic democratic principles for which generations of Europeans and Americans and people around the world have fought.
Leaving aside the question of democracy, the substance of this would be extensive privatization, more austerity, and the attempt to force Greece to pay 100 cents in the euro for its debts. Is this a coherent program? Will it work?
Under no circumstances. There are few certainties in life. Death and taxes are two of them, but this is the third one. This program is not going to work. I've been running some macro simulations in the last few weeks, and I was astonished to find that even if the privatization program runs according to plan. And there's no chance it will run according to plan, because they have pulled the number out of the hat as to how much money they expect to get from selling public assets, which is ludicrous, because, you know, this is a crumbling economy. It's an economy where there are no buyers, and they expect to sell assets more expensively than they could have sold them 5-10 years ago. It's ludicrous. But let's say that they manage it. Even if they manage it, and even if they meet every target that the European Union and the IMF is setting the Greek government, my simulations tell me, and it's not rocket science, it's just pure logic and very modest and uncontroversial assumptions go into it, that the Greek debt will explode by 2018 to 2019 to more than 210%. There is no way that this is going to be allowed to happen by Germany. Germany is not going to bankroll increasing debts, throw good money after bad. So the whole program of restructuring the Greek economy is going to blow up within a year or two. And you know what? I mean, I don't think that they're dumb people, and I think they know that. But they're just very cynical. They're simply buying time so that they can decide what they're going to do with the euro system as a whole. They have not worked out. They are in disarray in Brussels, in Frankfurt, in Berlin, in Paris. They are in complete and utter disarray. They want to lend Greece a little bit more money, well, a lot more money, actually, 50 to 60 billion is not a small fry, to tie it over until 2013. They know that their parliament is not going to be happy with this idea. Rightly so. Why should they be happy with the idea of throwing such a huge amount of money in a black hole? And they want some sweeteners for their own parliamentarians and their own electorates. And some symbolic acts of humiliating the Greeks and the Greek government, like forcing them to sell in a fire sale all important public assets, or reducing pensions for the extremely poor elderly Greeks and so on. These acts of humiliation may work quite nicely in Berlin, at least for a while, to placate parliamentarians and convince them to extend the 50-60 billion loans to Greece, which would tie Greece over until 2013 before the complete collapse happens then. Meanwhile, Germany and Holland and perhaps France hope to work out exactly what it is that they want to do with the Eurozone.
Now, could they just let the periphery go down in flames and then have the core of Europe remain solidly prosperous, or is their fate tied to the periphery as well?
Well, this is what they could. Well, the only thing they could do along those lines, and it's not insubstantial, is Germany, Holland, Austria, and Finland could simply get out of the euro. They have the capacity to get out of the euro. They could do it tomorrow. When you are in surplus, you can get out. When you're in deficit, you can't get out. But then again, so why aren't they doing it? That way they would jettison the problematic periphery and steam ahead. Well, not exactly, because let's not forget that these four economies that I mentioned, especially Germany and Holland, are neo-mercantilist economies. They're economies that function and reproduce themselves on the basis of aggressive export creation surpluses.
Well, it's also their banks that Greece owes the money to, isn't it?
I don't think that's their main concern. They can write this off. Their main concern is that if they form a new currency, a new joint currency or individual currencies, the Deutschmark could be extended to the other three countries, or they could each have their own. I think the best thing for them would be to stick together with one currency. But that currency will immediately revalue. It will double in value compared to the euro. And in this global environment, which is characterized by a dearth of aggregate demand, especially now with a slowing China and a faltering U.S. economy, Germany, Holland, Finland, and Austria will have an enormous recession in their hands. You know, if they're in this environment of currency wars and with a falling dollar, if the Deutschmark jumps up by 50, 60, 90% compared to the euro, they will lose a very large chunk of their Chinese export markets. German workers are already despondent. Unemployment in Germany has fallen significantly over the last 3-4 years, but at the expense of an increasing proportion of the working poor. The working poor in Germany are working much harder for less money and with lower living standards than before, a bit like the American workers were in the 1980s and 90s. Now, if the only thing that keeps them quiet and keeps them on the side of the German corporatist model is the fact that unemployment is so low. So if the German, the new German currency appreciates and suddenly orders for capital goods and Porsches and BMWs and so on are reduced by 50, 40, 60%, and suddenly workers are being laid off, I think that is a recipe for social unrest within Germany, and it will create serious problems for Germany's corporatist model. This is what is holding Mrs. Merkel back from jettisoning the rest of the periphery by recreating the Deutschmark.
I saw Tim Geithner speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations a few weeks ago, and he was actually kind of crowing about how well the United States is doing compared to Europe. He's, you know, people say we have troubles, but you know, look over there, ha ha ha. Is he right to be complacent, or would the explosion of the euro have effects on the United States and the rest of the outside world?
Well, he has no right to be complacent because he's not ruling the economic policy of your country, if I'm not mistaken. It's only Bernanke who has a degree, a modicum of control over what he's doing, with Congress and the administration vetoing each other into oblivion. I think that Mr. Geithner should think twice about gloating. Having said that, he's got a point. I think that economic historians over the next 50, 100 years will be looking at European leaders and officials and the way that they've been handling this crisis now, and they will be writing one textbook after the other as how not to address a crisis.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. Yanis has devised what he calls a modest proposal for solving the euro crisis. You can find it on the web by Googling his first name, Yanis, Y-A-N-I-S, and modest proposal. And you'll find his blog as well by doing that, Y-A-N-I-S, and modest proposal. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, since we're in a euro mood, a bit of Laibach doing Jesus Christ Superstar, an example of their aesthetics of radical ambiguity. Till next week, bye.
Such a backward time in such a strange land. If you'd come today, you'd have reached the whole nation.